Welcome to Apple at Work, the podcast all about Apple and the enterprise. My name is Bradley Chambers, your host. Back again for part two of our series is Weldon Dodd from Kanji. Weldon, welcome back to Apple at Work.
Hey, Bradley, great to see you again.
So we talked last time about, I tried to sum it up as like the impact of the iPhone, because talking about the history is one thing, but like I think understanding like the impact of these products is I think what we're trying to aim. And this week we wanted to talk about the Mac, which is experiencing its 40-year birthday. And I was born right around the time the Mac was started. And so from these early days of the Mac, I mean we're talking off air about you bought your first Mac in the 80s. It was the first time you had used one. What was it like to use one of these early products?
Yeah, it was really different. So much different than today, because computers were new. Their personal computers were kind of a hobbyist endeavor early on. So my first Apple product was a Apple II Plus in 1982. It had the 48K language card and, dual disk drives and all that. It was really tricked out and a ton of fun. But, you had to pop inside and mess around with cards and set IDs on cards for the bus and all this kind of nonsense that you don't have to do today. So it was a really different experience. But early on, even with the Mac, you could see that there was something different about it. The mouse and keyboard that we're all used to now, or trackpad and keyboard today, really just brought a new innovation to the whole space that was amazing at the time. I taught computer classes while I was in university, and I would teach faculty and staff how to use computers. And I might have mentioned this before, but I ran the Mac lab and the Next lab. And one of the things that we had to teach early on was, this is a mouse. Its tail always points away from you, right? And that's how you hold it, because people would turn it sideways and not understand why the cursor was moving left and right instead of up and down as they physically moved it away from them and towards them, right? Because they had it turned sideways. So there was a lot of learning to do, but people caught on quick and it became really useful. One thing we were talking about was just how important the spreadsheet was to the rise of the personal computer in business. So VisiCalc was one of the first spreadsheet applications that actually started on the Apple II, and that transferred over to the Mac. Lotus 1-2-3. There's a bit of a rivalry between those two companies. The founders were friendly with each other. But then we've got Microsoft Multiplan and then Microsoft Excel. And going into the 90s, Microsoft Office really took over and became a great set of tools for people to use in business.
Yeah, Office, it's not as important today. I mean, I think the idea of productivity and collaboration software is obviously still critical. But like if the Mac lost access to the Office suite today, I don't think the world would end. Like I don't think the Mac's dominance, because so much of that stuff is either happening in the web, so a Google Workspace, or even if you're company has an Office 365 subscription, like you could just access it in the web, and you see the power of, say, what the web office tools can do compared to what we were used to even 5-6 years ago. And then so much of it now is about simultaneous editing and collaboration. Office was very symbolic, I think, in the 90s. I remember using like Office 97, and like that was what work was on a computer. Like you didn't, if you weren't in Office, like you were not working. And that really permeated up until the mid 2000 as well. And so you're seeing this time, like in the 80s and 90s, the hardware is, I mean, compared to what we have today, like just is so archaic. But if you had a long enough view, like you knew it was going to get a lot better, a lot faster, really, really quickly. But I think you mentioned education. I think one of the things that helps, if you've ever worked in an environment where like the people there kind of like are not tech natives, it gives you a insight into like how technology will be successful. And And that's, I think, one of the things that Apple has always at its core been great at. And did I mention on our last podcast that I was looking at buying an MP3 player? Did I mention that?
No.
Okay. So like straight up MP3. Okay. So I love music. I've been an Apple Music subscriber since day one. In fact, the iPod back in 2004 was like my first Apple product. I bought my first Mac. So I was like the halo effect.
Yeah.
But I'm like, you know, obviously I've got a phone and things, but like, I kind of want to get lost in the music again. I kind of just like want an MP3 player. Like that way, if I want to like go for a walk around the neighborhood, like I just don't have my phone with me. And it's, I understand, like I can just put it in airplane mode. Like I understand that, but it's like, it's almost more of a symbolic thing with my mind is like, I just want to be offline a little bit. So I even thought, like, obviously Apple doesn't make iPods anymore. They discontinued the iPod Classic. I mean, maybe a decade ago. And you can buy an old iPod Touch, but kind of, again, it's more of a smartphone without the phone. And so like, I went on this hunt, like, I'm going to buy an MP3 player. And I went on, there's countless of them on Amazon, like just countless knockoff, brands. I ordered 7, 8 of them, got them all in this weekend. I'm talking within 5 minutes, I knew every one of these things was garbage, like absolute hot garbage. And this was what MP3 players were before Apple got involved too. Like if, remember the whole plays for sure. Like you were seeking these things. It was just like, it's like nobody, like only major tech savvy people would even go through this process. And so like, I realized like, well, nothing's changed. Clearly like Apple still had best MP3 player. So I went on eBay and like, little did I know that's like people still selling a lot of iPod Classics, but what they're doing is they're like refurbishing old iPods. So they're putting in like massive SSDs and very small. So you can buy like an iPod Classic with like a 2 terabyte drive, brand new batteries that last forever. And because obviously like technology has evolved as the iPod format has stayed the same. So like, yeah, I bought me a classic, an old iPod, and I'm going to get my music. Yeah, I still have a collection of MP3s. I'm going to sync my music and sync my books over to it. And I'm going to have me an iPod.
Nice.
But I say all that to say, like, there were better MP3 players on the market when Apple released the iPod, but Apple knew, like, we're going to make the product for, like, the regular person, and we're going to make it easy to sync, and, like, we're going to make everything easy to use and in some ways a delight to use. And so I think when I think about, like, computers and the usability of them, there have always been better computers spec-wise that were cheaper. Or I'll say less expensive, shouldn't say cheaper, that were for always sure. less expensive than anything Apple would produce. But what Apple always built is the device, the computer, the MP3 player, the phone, the tablet for the rest of us. Like the people that like wanted the device to be a tool and not to be something necessarily like you would tinker with. And is that kind of what you remember about the Mac in the 80s and 90s?
Yeah, for sure. You know, the original Mac was – I think the vision was to make it more of an appliance, right? I think Steve Jobs said that explicitly. And it was very different than the Apple II where, you would open the lid, you could see the NuBus slots in there and pull them out and rearrange them and do different things. And the Mac was this self-contained unit that you turned on. It gave this pleasant little chime as it booted up, a nice friendly little face on it that still survives today in the Finder icon. It was just a very different experience of using the device. It's remarkable, I think, thinking back to our previous episode about the iPhone. Like the iPhone is an even more pure expression of that idea of a computing device that you just pick up and intuitively use. Like I'm sure many of us have had the experience of seeing a small child pick up an iPad or an iPhone. And they learn very quickly how to navigate, to swipe between pages, tap an icon to launch an app, use the home button or the close button or whatever, right? And the Mac is still a personal computer in the sense that even though it's easier to use, there's a lot of arcane knowledge that you have to assemble in order to use it effectively. And many of us have been doing that for 30, 40 years, decades, and it's second nature at this point. But I don't think we should understate, it took a bit of work to learn how to use a file system and where to put things and what does it mean that you have a system extension or today, what does it mean to have apps installed in different places and different versions of it and what are config profiles and all these other things that you're faced with a little more directly in a Mac than you are with some of the other products.
This episode of Apple at Work is sponsored by Muzzle. Deploying, managing, and protecting Apple devices at work shouldn't be difficult or require several solutions. Muzzle is the only Apple unified platform for business. By combining enhanced device management, endpoint security, internet privacy and security, single sign-on, and enhanced app management into a single Apple-only platform, businesses can now easily and automatically deploy, manage, protect their Apple devices automatically with one solution at an affordable price. With a solution for every business size and the best support in the market, start a free 30-day trial and see firsthand why Mozilla is more than an Apple MDM. Mozilla is everything you need to work with Apple. To learn more, visit business.mozyle.com. That's business.mosyle.com. Thanks to Mozyle for sponsoring Apple at Work this week.
Well, and I think that that is the discussion we've been having with the iPad since its release. It's like, what is the future of computing? Is it still the Mac, or is it an interface and more like the iPad that it strips away that complexity? Because I would still agree, like having kids that kind of have grown up knowing how to navigate an iPad, and like now that they're kind of venturing into like using a Mac, they don't know it. And that's not saying they can't learn it, because like, you know, obviously we all learned it, but I think we all had the advantage of like growing up with like, I mean, I remember the first time I saw Windows 95, you're like, oh, well, I mean, this was crazy. Like this was, it was just a different, you had that, you learned along the way, where kids say you're like kind of having to pick that up, where our interfaces went from very complex to easier over time. A lot of kids today are going to have to do the reverse and go from interfaces that are very simple and easy to use to, again, like you said, that there's still some legacy, I don't know, cruft baggage. Like, and it's not wrong. It's just, you know, it the Mac is the Mac for a reason, and it's not the iPod, not the iPad. So, you know, I thinking through like this, you know, when I started like, you know, graduating high school, going to college, the Mac was in a weird spot, and it obviously this is the time that Jobs had left. What was it like to be a Mac user late 90s, early 2000s? What did that feel like?
Yeah, it was different. So some of that excitement around the Mac definitely started to fade in the 90s. So this is about when I started my professional career. And so as an example, I was doing a lot of work with Cisco, and I was a network engineer and doing things there. And all of the tools that we had to work on configuring routers and switches and whatnot, they were all Windows based. And there weren't any tools for the Mac. Sort of as an aside, this was also an era when TCP/IP support wasn't included in the operating system, and you had to install it separately. And the Mac just wasn't very good for those problems at the time. So what changed significantly is when OS X was introduced, and in the early 2000s. And that meant it was built on top of a Unix foundation. TCP/IP was included. And the Unix underpinnings of the Mac were a lot closer to the Linux foundation that the web was built on, that the internet was being built on. And so that shift was huge. All of a sudden, the Mac became a platform that was closely related to what everyone was spending their time working on and building. And that switched for network engineering. So just within 10 years, right, all the Cisco engineers that I work with went from having Windows laptops to having Mac laptops. All of the developers switched from doing a lot of their work on Windows PCs to building software on the Mac because, frankly, like you mentioned before, software moved from desktop software to web software. And the Mac was a great platform for building things on the web because the similarity between the BSD underpinnings of the Mac and Linux that a lot of the websites ran on and web applications run on today. So yeah, there definitely was a big shift. I still had a Mac through those years, you know, but I didn't buy one every year, certainly every few years, because most of my work was being done on PC, and I had the Mac around because I liked it and it was fun, but it wasn't how I was making my living.
Yeah, I think there was that cohort of people that kept the Apple dream alive. And it's like, you know, yeah, it wasn't as fun. It was kind of awkward for years, but like you still knew, like, you know, what's I think there was a quote where, like, you know, Steve Jobs even said, like, why are y'all still here? Like, those great engineers, mm-hmm. like, you know, basically, like, they bleed in six colors, and it's homage to the old Apple logo. And so there was, like, that fire, maybe it got a little dim, but it never went out. And I sort of almost think it's kind of like, you know, everybody keeps saying, like, oh, Bitcoin's going to die, like, Bitcoin's going to zero, like, it's going to go away. And, like, yeah, it goes up and down, it's volatile, but then it just keeps going and comes back. And, like, as we record this podcast, looks like it's about to cross over 50,000 again. And it was 16,000, you know, a year and 3 months ago. But it's like, it's kind of the same thing where there's this cohort of believers that, like, don't let the light go out. And like, it was people like you that just, yeah, maybe you had to use a PC for things, but you still preferred your Mac. And that, I think that's okay. And I think one of the things that, like, in that time period, people were more hobbyist, and like, I remember building computers, and like, that sort of mindset was never in Apple's DNA of like, you know, especially in the 90s and 2000s, like they wanted to build you a complete system. They wanted to sell computers to people that just wanted to be in somebody's appliance versus like, I'm going to build this. And the industry followed Apple. I mean, like, building a PC today is certainly even less common than it was in the early 2000s. It was just, you know, it's just, you, people just buy it, want it to work. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you see, you know, get kind of, you know, OS 10 comes out, and there's a start to be some flickers of hope, flickers of, you know, growth. And then I, you know, you say all that talking about that TCP underpinning. And when you think about the term like iMac, iBook, it means more because it was an internet native device. And I think that's as much what led to Apple's, that was like the fuel that sparked once, you know, you had kind of the gas on the ground with the iMac and the iBook and some of these things. And when the iPod came on, it kind of, you know, sparked that match that led to some, you know, really cool things. And so, again, you see the iPod is released in the, you know, was it, it was right after 9/11, I remember, late 01. And again, like, little fanfare, some, but like, it just kept slowly. And then Apple, its view in pop culture changed. Like, it became a very much more of a hip company again. Again, you remember those iPod commercials where it was the silhouettes dancing, and like, the perception of Apple changed to, like, I don't know, people around my age at that time. And it was like, Apple was hip. Mm-hmm. And then you know, the product placement Apple did at the time of, like, you know, I remember, like, in Legally Blonde, very, very interesting product placement with the clamshell. I guess it was the iBook. And like, it was just, you know, it was very strategic, things like that, that like, Apple began planting seeds in everybody's mind.
Yeah. Yeah. The, you know, the 80s, right, was desktop publishing, the LaserWriter. That was the output that, you know, computers were good for at the time. That survived into the 90s, you know, and then the 2000s, the internet came along, and that kind of changed the game again. And I mean, obviously the internet came along before that, but I mean, it became popular, right?
It became mainstream, like, where you're, part of people's somewhat everyday life.
Yeah. I remember IBM built their website in 1995, right? And that really was the beginning of the internet being for work. But you're right. Then the iPod came along and introduced Apple to a whole new set of people that hadn't seen it before. They got introduced to the Mac through that. And then, you know, not too many years later, 2007, the iPhone comes along, and now everybody's interested in Apple.
Right. And so, again, really during this time, Microsoft Office, like, kind of looms large in this, like, weird transition where it's, you know, people want to use the Mac at work, but then, like, the Office experience isn't really there. And then you remember that, you know, the WWDC when Steve Jobs, you know, had Bill Gates announce that, like, hey, we're committing to Microsoft Office. Yeah. He got booed, and a lot of Apple fans were like, no. But, like, I think that was a symbolic moment. Like, you needed to be relevant in the time period for desktop computing. Like, you need a Microsoft Office, whether Apple wanted to admit it or not. And again, this is, like, you know, years before iWork would become kind of even somewhat of an alternative. And I would even argue it never became a true alternative in the workplace. But, like, Apple needed Office during that transition in some ways much more than Microsoft needed Apple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I mean, the history there is interesting because the Mac had productivity applications from the beginning. We had Mac Write and Mac Paint and some other things. But Word came along, and Word was an excellent program on the Mac. Word 5.1 particularly was a standard that everyone enjoyed. It was considered to be a really outstanding Mac application. But then, you know, some things changed, and I'm not sure exactly what to ascribe it to, but what was clear was that Microsoft was putting a lot more effort into building the Windows versions of those applications than they were in building the Macintosh versions of those applications. And it's hard to understand today maybe, but it was a really big deal to figure out how to convert files that were in different formats back and forth between Mac and PC users. And it created a lot of friction in the workplace when someone would write a Word document on the Mac and someone on a Windows computer would need to open that same Word document. Even though they both had Word, they used different file formats and, you know, they weren't completely interchangeable. And sometimes there was issues with fonts and other kinds of features. And that changed in the, I guess it was 98 or 97 when Bill Gates was at Macworld. I was actually there for that one. I lived in the Bay Area and was still following Apple, but that all changed. And so that's been one of the things that really helped out was that commitment to keep the Mac versions of Office up to date and more current. And eventually we got to a more portable document format. DocX and all of that really helped out quite a bit. And then, like as you said, nowadays we don't even think about it because all that work is being done using web applications. And if you ever send a file around, it's the exception; it's not the rule.
Right. The idea of sending in an actual attachment, you're like, I'm sorry, what are we doing? You're like, you need to send me a share link. Mm-hmm. But again, you don't get to where we're at without coming where we've been. And I think that's the important thing there. Like it was strategic for Microsoft to make sure they still were the de facto default work, you know, file format. And to this day, even as popular as Google Docs is, there's a reason that you can still download that as a Word doc because it's still the de facto format. Yeah. One of the things that was happening during this time too is obviously like Exchange is the default way to do corporate email, and Microsoft Entourage was kind of there, but like it wasn't great. I mean, the Mac, the Office version on the Mac today is really, really good. Particularly on the iPhone, it's actually really, really good. They bought that many years ago, but I remember like there was an app called Snerdware or something that you could use on like Tiger, and maybe around that time, like you could actually make the mail app sync with Exchange, and then I believe it was Snow Leopard. That again, Apple's growing during this time, but then Snow Leopard, and among its no new features release, it's some people still consider that to be the gold standard of releases. But I remember it wasn't perfect, but it added native Exchange support, and I would argue that especially during that time period, it was easier to add an Exchange account to a Mac than it was to a PC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a great period. I remember. I was working for Apple at that time, and that it was a huge deal, right? It really helped out with business sales. It helped with adoption across the enterprise and within businesses. A lot of the motion at that time was really centered around the C-suite and executives because, they would get, they'd get an iPod, they'd want a Mac. And then they want to hook it up to their work email, right? That was like the main application or the killer application at the time was email. And that drove it drove IT teams, right, to figure out how to let the Mac talk to email. And so many companies, like you said, used Exchange that it was just critical to be able to access your Exchange mailbox from a Mac. That was it. You know, it was the only way it was going to work. there were, you know, sometimes weird gateways to enable POP or some other protocol to Exchange, but no one wanted to do those. So having native Exchange support was a huge difference.
Well, and that was ultimately important for Microsoft too, because what the risk, like if Microsoft had just said no and wouldn't license that technology to Apple, the risk there is that like a competitor comes along and starts, people start moving away from Exchange. And obviously they did with Google and things. There is a stronger competitor now, but it was really in hindsight, very important for Microsoft to make sure it, because Microsoft really became a cloud first company, to like anything it offers, it needs to work everywhere. And, but again, that was like pretty big at the time. I would argue really that time period, if you had a Mac at work, you were like among a very low maintenance person, because honestly, I remember I used a Mac at work and you sort of like, I'm not going to complain a whole lot. I'm going to figure this stuff out because I'm afraid if I complain a lot, they're going to take it from me and make me use a PC. So right. You're like, yeah, I'll figure out how to set up my own printer.
Keep your head down.
Your head down. I'll just access it from there. I was like, you know, this was, you know, the time when even like the web interface for Exchange was like awful. If you were not using Internet Explorer, because Internet Explorer used a lot of like ActiveX technology, but like, you know, just like, that's fine. I'm good. I don't want to mess with it. And so they were really, you know, this was around the time when like Windows and spyware and this is Service Pack 1, Service Pack 2, like that was a big concern. And the big thing on the Mac is there quote unquote were no viruses. And obviously there's like exploits today and you can get malware and obviously PCs are much better today, but like that was the like winning argument at the time was like, well, Macs don't get viruses and PCs do, and they're more secure. And yeah, it was just like, it was really a nice period. Like this was like a great period, particularly when like Windows was not in a fun place at the time. This is like the XP Service Pack 2, the Vista, Windows Me. Like these were kind of some garbage releases in hindsight. And it was not a fun period to be there. And so the Mac just like chugged along for years. Like it was, we went through the Intel transition and like these were some great computers. I remember, you know, Apple stayed, you know, kind of ahead of the game on hardware. They had really, really robust wireless technology and the Macs in those periods. Like it was a nice period. Apple wasn't growing in the business world like it is today, but it became like, it was not foreign to see somebody have one.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up Internet Explorer in there because I think that's a really important part of this history too. Like Internet Explorer that was part of that 97 deal with Bill Gates, right? Office was in there, but Internet Explorer coming to the Mac was part of that deal too. And for a while, Internet Explorer was the default web browser on the Mac, and it was great. It was the best browser that you could run on your Mac at the time. It was really well-rounded, lots of features. It ran fast. It was performant. It was really good. But what happened over time, right, was there was a fight going on. Microsoft was trying to add more ActiveX controls into the web to make it more like, closer ties to Windows, right, and leverage their power advantage on the desktop into the web. And it was a fight. It was a battle, right, with a bunch of people across a bunch of different companies really pushing back against that idea of what the web should be. And eventually it came to a head where Apple had to create their own web browser. And they created WebKit and Safari. And Safari, I think it shouldn't be overlooked as how important it was to the Mac surviving through the 2000s, because if they hadn't pushed back on that, it'd be difficult to imagine what the world would be like if Microsoft had been allowed to maintain a huge advantage with the web browser. And, you know, there obviously there's a multitude of options with Chrome and Firefox and a new breed of work browsers, you know, security-minded browsers and others. But even Chrome is based on WebKit. Mm-hmm. Chromium is a fork of that work that Apple did and others did. So, I think I was just thinking about, you know, all these different threads that we've been talking about, how the Mac survived and has flourished. Safari was a really important part of that.
Yeah, I agree. And even if it is it the top market share today? No, but probably on mobile, you could argue it because it's Apple's so dominant. But it's really more, it's it's very symbolic because ActiveX was a source of a lot of security problems on the web, like major part of it. And this is around the time period too, where on the PC, Firefox was gaining traction. And I remember there was like this big New York Times ad. They took it, Internet Explorer was very security, had security problems at the time. Like, it's kind of like if you were using that, like you needed, remember the old toolbars, pop-up blockers? I mean, it was like, browser was awful.
Drive-by downloads on the PC were a thing where it just, the browser would download files and execute them without the user even knowing.
It was awful. And so Firefox became getting popular. And I remember they took out a big New York Times ad, I think it was 04. And like people donated towards this ad. And like, if you go find that ad, like if you look close enough, my name's in it because I donated to the ad. And so like around this time, again, you had Firefox was there on the PC side. Then Safari was there on the Mac side. So it kind of lessened Microsoft's dominance in terms of what it could do. And then Chrome came along and obviously it took massive market share. And I feel like now there's enough. I mean, obviously Chrome is so popular, but there is like enough of a dispersion of users and it's so easy to switch that it keeps everybody honest. And you're even seeing that now on mobile, like with some of the things in the EU where Apple's almost going through what Microsoft did with this antitrust stuff and it being built in, like they're almost getting that on the mobile side where they're kind of having to make it easier for other browsers. And I think competition is good, but Internet Explorer is a huge part of this history and Safari is pretty critical to that. And if it wasn't for Safari, then who knows where the web would be today.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and it's through this time period, like, chugging along, get the iPhone comes out, the iPad comes out. And then we're just, again, chugging along, go through the 2010s. And Intel is fine. But like similar to where they were with PowerPC, Apple ran into limits of what it wanted to do with PowerPC and needed to make the shift to Intel. Mm-hmm. And I remember I love the PowerBook G4. That was like just such a great computer, but they never could make a PowerBook G5 because it was just too hot. And Apple, I mean, these Intel chips were towards the end, they were fine. Like, Apple was largely in some ways held up on the desktop because of some limitations of Intel. But you were seeing on the mobile side where their own chips were like doing incredible. Mm-hmm. So there was rumors for years, and in 2020, they finally announced at WWDC that Apple Silicon was coming. And then that fall, they released the first computer with its M1 and kind of the rest is history. And I would argue that the Apple MacBook Air with M1, like you could still use that computer today and you would be fine with it. And I think this has kind of kicked off like a new generation of a Mac experience, just like the Intel did. And Apple, I would argue the Mac is in the healthiest place it is hardware-wise and software-wise as it's ever been. Like these are in some ways like these should be considered the glory days.
Yeah. Yeah, we've been through, I guess what, four processor families now, the 68K in the original Mac and then PowerPC and then Intel and now Apple Silicon. And, Intel was super important in that era because it allowed for Windows emulation on the device and it provided a bridge, right, for people to move from Windows-based workflows and Windows-based applications, many of which were document-based workflows, right, to be able to still do that on their Mac. But as the industry has shifted away from desktop applications and managing files and sending those around to the web, right, that the hold that Windows had on office productivity has been loosened. And I think that's really allowed Apple to make this transition to Apple Silicon without a lot of fear or uncertainty or a lot of danger around maintaining that compatibility with Intel-based operating systems or emulation like Windows. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how well it's been executed. The Apple Silicon was just a revelation in terms of performance and battery life. Laptops are the sort of de facto computing device for macOS today. And that ability to get amazing battery life out of a laptop with Apple Silicon is a huge advantage. It's more important to most people, I think, than just raw performance that would be available if you're running at with a higher wattage CPU that generated a lot more heat and used a lot more power. I think people actually realized that, hey, there's plenty of power in Apple Silicon just as it is, but I'm super glad I get 5-6 hours of battery on my laptop. I know Apple advertises higher battery length, life or whatever, but I mean, you know, I guess I use my computer a little bit more than the Tesla.
I think to me, the symbolic thing is like the Air doesn't have the, you know, the doesn't fan and it works. And Apple is in some ways in control of their own destiny here. And I think it's just, it's, and again, I think would really be what Hayter says if we didn't mention Rosetta and Rosetta 2. So Rosetta was the technology that allowed PowerPC to apps to run on Intel and it worked well. And then as developers ported their apps over to Intel, and then with Rosetta 2, it was continuing to allow your Intel native apps to run on Apple Silicon, again, with some emulation in the background, but it happened very seamlessly. And Apple just nailed it. And I mean, we've been talking for, 35 minutes, and there's no way to sum up like Apple's complete Mac history, but, you know, 35 minutes properly. And I'm sure there's 1,000 things we've missed. But I think the thing that I want to get across to people is – there were 1,000 places where Apple could have gone wrong, and that the Mac isn't really what it is. Like it's just, it's almost like a Linux version. Like it has Linux market share, but Apple always had the users. Like they always were going after that average user and making it a delight to use their computers and delight. Like it was like they wanted to make it the computer for the normal people, like regular people that like weren't a hobbyist, weren't a tinker, like just wanted it to work.
The computer for the rest of us.
Right.
That was the phrase back then. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember, you know, I remember when they even launched Mobile Me, it was called Exchange for the Rest of Us. And it was like meant to be that. So that, I think that's, as long as Apple continues to put its users' experiences first, they'll continue to win. And that was a challenge in the early days because like IT teams wanted them to build things just for IT. But like Apple, and Apple does that today, but like always keeping that user experience behind. And I think, you know, this is like 2024 is, I think, the best time ever to be a Mac user.
Yeah, I think I'd have to agree with that.
So I agree. So, Weldon, thanks for coming on. It's been fun kind of going down memory lane. We have one more of these to talk about, which is the iPad, which is in some ways the shortest. So, but again, thanks for everybody for listening, and we will see you next time.